Welcome to another Media Talk. Coming up this week...
In a moment, Simon Callow will talk about Mozart and Jack D will talk about comedy and being miserable. And a timely reminder about BST.
Trebles all round at Radio 4. What's the secret of their radar success? Plus, is Greg Dyke poised to return from the broadcasting wilderness as Channel 4's new chairman? Also in the podcast, Ofcom and BSkyB lock horns over premium sports and movie packages, and...
Frank left you, your boys left you, and now Roy's left you.
You think Frank wants you, mutton dressed as lamb?
You cow! Oh, flaming will kill you!
Barbara Windsor calls time at the Old Vic. How will EastEnders cope without Peggy Mitchell? I'm Matt Wells, and this is Media Talk from The Guardian. This week, the Chinese ambassador put down her Ferrero Rocher to make an official complaint about her noisy neighbours in North London. Madame Fu Ying, of course, lives next door to the X Factor mansion, which is apparently besieged by teenage fans day and night, eager to catch a glimpse of the gruesome Grimes twins. Well, Her Excellency, I'm sure, would have no problem asking for a cup of sugar from either of my panellists. Here with me in the studio, we have Janine Gibson, who is the editor of Guardian.co.uk, and Paul Robinson, who's the managing director of Kidsco TV and Globe Trotter par excellence. Paul, give us a flavour of where you've been in the 8 weeks since you were last on the podcast.
8 weeks. Gosh, I think you've 2 weeks. Well, I've been to Singapore, I've been to Korea, I've been to Indonesia and Malaysia.
What have you been up to there?
I've been filming orangutans in the Borneo rainforest for Kidsco, and absolutely amazing. You sort of fall in love with these animals. You realise I'm quite close to an orangutan, I think, in many yes. ways, but I'm not hairy and orange.
Well, you're slightly orange after your trip, obviously. When is this channel going to launch in Britain?
Very good question. We're in 58 countries, not the UK. Next year, I'm saying that.
Okay, all right. Nice work if you can get it, Janine.
Yeah, it sounds to me like he's been on the old Grand Prix circuit, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia.
Yes, close.
Are you working for Bernie Eccleston?
Fortunately not.
You're the new Max Mosley?
Definitely not.
Okay, now let's have a look. Just before we go too far down that route, now, Janine, you've admitted in the past to being a dyed-in-the-wool Radio 4 fan, haven't you? So sit back for a moment and enjoy this.
It's 6 o'clock on Tuesday, the 27th of October. Good morning, this is Today with John Humphreys and Evan Davis.
If that first year when you saw it, if you left it there, but with a spade or a knife, you went in at an angle and cut the root about 5 inches, 4 inches below the surface. Don't disturb it.
We present the News Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Yes, we start this week with the champagne glasses raised at Radio 4. The BBC's Quality Speech Station is celebrating an excellent set of radar figures, which show its highest listener numbers since 1999. Its audience has broken through the 10 million barrier once again. So what's the secret behind the success? Janine, it can't just be Steve Hewlett.
Oh, God, no, I'm certain it is. I'd forgotten about him. Absolutely, Steve, it's all down to him. Do you know, this takes me back to before the days when I was a dyed-in-the-wool Radio 4 fan, when the first time I met Rod Liddell, back before he was an agitprop right-wing columnist,
yes.
when he was just a sort of slightly pinko lefty editor of the Day programme. The first time I met him, I was probably about 27, 28, media correspondent, desperate for some stories about Radio 4. And we went out for a drink, and I said, I can't stand the Today programme. All these middle-aged men banging on, arguing with each other. It's so irrelevant. It's not relevant to people like me. You're just, you know, you're old and you're dead. And he just looked at me in this incredibly withering way, and he said, come back to me in 7 years.
So here we are now.
This did slightly occur to me when I was looking
at... Listening to the Today programme.
Listening to the Today programme. Worrying about my Radio 4 comedy podcast download and has it synced and buying my bumper box sets if I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, whatever, and thinking, is this just because we are all getting older and so therefore we are listening to more radio? Or is it distinctiveness? Or is it distribution? Or is it the death of the rivals? You know, commercial radio has kind of melted away quite a lot. And I suspect probably the reasons are a bit of all of those things and a bit of, you know, smart programming and just dedicated resource focusing on what they do and doing it very well. But I did ask Twitter
Yeah. What did Twitter say?
Well, I attempt to engage with the young people. Then I realised everybody that I talk to on Twitter is also old. But they all said, some of them said brilliant programmes and some of them said all of the above. But actually, the absolute consensus was, against a backdrop of a bit of people are interested in harder news because of the recession or because of the global climate, most people said, we're just getting older.
Paul, do you think that's right? Or Janine alluded to maybe a bit of smarter programming. Mark Damaser has made some smart moves, hasn't he?
He has. And you have to say, actually, that the current figures show that Radio 4 is working right across the board, actually. Everything,
news.
You know, it's not just news. You know, Woman's Hour, You and Yours, they're all doing the afternoon play. They're all doing fantastically. I think, you know, Janine's hit on it. But I think there's also something else going on. That is that Radio 4 has really no competition. And it has been growing its audience for the last 5 years, very quietly, very slowly, every quarter. It just happens to have broken through 10 million this time, which obviously makes it, you know, a big, big story. But also, I think it's less likely to be attacked by new media, you know, in a way that, you know, podcasts and iPods and other things can actually attack music radio. It's harder to attack Radio 4 because it's live largely. You know, it's got lots of different genres. It's quality. You know, there's only one Radio 4 experience, which is Radio 4. So I think it sort of sails through in this new technology world, ironically, far better than the music competition.
And there's a thing that there's a thing they do which I think we have to give them credit for, because it is not easy, which is to reinvent very long-running things and make them relevant for a different audience. And
Woman's Hour, You and Yours. Sorry, I haven't a clue.
I mean, I'm particularly impressed with things like I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue and Just a Minute, which, you know, if you'd said to me 10 years ago this will be something that you will heartily just look forward to, and I'd say, don't be ridiculous. But they gently refresh it while still staying true to the original. To be able to carry on with I'm Sorry, I Haven't a Clue without Humphrey Littleton, and to give it a new lease of life, to take Just a Minute and bring in people like David Mitchell, like Sue Perkins, who feel relevant to a new audience of people who probably feel a bit left out by BBC Three and don't get particularly excited by Katie Brand, but are slightly David Mitchell obsessives, maybe, if there are any of those people out there.
I don't know any of those people. But also, Paul mentioned the new media thing. Actually, Radio 4 has embraced new media really well. All their shows are on podcast. They're all on the iPlayer. They've got a good blog going, which links out to brings together a lot of the stuff that they're doing. And they're doing quite well at engaging a younger and new media literate audience in their programmes, aren't they? Mm.
And it doesn't feel like you're hanging out with a different generation.
It 10 years ago, it did feel a bit stuffy. It definitely did.
Absolutely.
And it's done that despite Radio 5 Live, you know, clearly, you know, potentially clicking at its heels. The other thing to look at in the radio figures...
I was going to say, is it because Radio 4 is so good or because Radio 5 Live is bad?
Well, Radio 5 Live's done pretty well as well. I mean, Radio 5 Live seems to have a life that sits alongside Radio 4, and the two don't seem to cannibalise each other too very, too badly. What I was going to say, the other thing to look at in the radio figures is not just the number of listeners, but also the loyalty, which is measured by the hours per listener. Mm. And what's interesting, if you look at Radio 4, people who like Radio 4 like it more even than Radio 2. It's got the highest loyalty of any of the BBC networks. So that says not only do they actually, lots of people come to it, but those who come to it really like it and they stay with it for a long time. And that's the real mark of a radio station. Mm. If you look at you know, Radio 4 compared to, say, something like Capital, Radio 4's got double the loyalty of Capital.
I was going to say, is there anything else? You are Mr. Radio Expert. Well, what else should we be picking out from this quarter's radio figures?
Well, commercial radio's done okay. I mean, they've basically held their position. You know, they're not declining anymore, so I think they're fairly happy with that. In London, you've still got Magic at 1, Heart at 2 and Capital at 3 on Reach, but Capital is growing its average hours. So it looks like Capital is coming out. It looks like Global are getting Capital out of the mire it was in. And I guess the other thing is the rise of digital. Digital continues to grow steadily and surely, and, you know, it's a long road, but digital is still growing.
I'd like to say something about Absolute Radio, which we've sort of criticised. We certainly criticised a lot when they relaunched, and we thought their name was a bit rubbish, and we thought their music policy was a bit rubbish. But actually, particularly, and I go back to new media and digital, they've done this really interesting thing where they've set up one Golden Square lab. So they've employed these people to just go away and think about digital, and they've started churning out loads and loads of really interesting things. I'm not sure it's particularly been reflected in the radars, but it's a really interesting station. What's going on there is really interesting.
They're really embracing it. They're not regarding themselves as a traditional radio station. They're thinking about reinventing themselves for a digital world.
And they're really the only commercial group doing that.
They are, and they're also doing it very strongly commercially too, because they're not just relying on
spot advertising. A lot of their revenue comes not just from ads on the radio station, they're really growing that. The thing for Absolute, I think, is what they're suffering from is the fact the Virgin radio station probably had over-attribution in the old radar because, you know the name Virgin, and so it's an easy one to say, yes, I listen to it. Absolute's a non-brand, and now it's probably getting the real audience they had before. It's just, unfortunately, Absolute have been tarred with losing the audience. They probably haven't actually lost a single listener.
All right, interesting stuff.
While we're doing people that we may have misjudged slightly, one of the things that we're kind of zeroing around on the BBC radio output is a better and clearer delineation between their stations. And we can say that that's possibly because Five Live has redefined itself, which I think it has. I think it has moved into more of a talk radio station than a speech radio station. They have become we might say negatively, quite demotic in their programme choices and the sorts of call-ins that they do. And that's fine, because it's not really aimed at us anymore. They don't really, we're all apparently very, very super served by Radio 4, and that's great. But also Radio 2 is growing. Radio 2 is not being affected. You know, their listenership is extremely happy and still continuing to spread. And Radio 1 is not, temporarily in crisis.
That's true. There's one thing that I would say, Janine, sorry to interrupt you, and that is there is a problem with Radio 1 and Radio 2 music. And those two stations haven't quite got the complementarity right at the moment. You can often listen to Radio 2 and find a more modern song on there than you can on Radio 1. I think there's definitely an issue with music policy on Radio 1 and Radio 2. Aside from that, I agree with you.
No, and I'm just interested if perhaps, I fully believe that Mark Damser and so on are doing an excellent job, but I wonder if there's something about the appointment as a head of radio, somebody who is of a marketing background, that would absolutely be quite rigorous about what the remit of these things are, and has enabled some sort of clarity there. And given that we have been quite critical of Tim Davey, I'm giving him props.
I think Tim Davey is actually doing a very good job, and I agree with you. I think he's got real clarity of what those brands stand for, and he's definitely moved things on. Jenny did a great job, but Tim has taken it to another level.
Let's move on quickly before we get too far
it's
down
nearly
that road.
Christmas, that's all I'm saying.
Very nice of you. Tell us what you think. Post a comment on our blog at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk. From Radio 4 to Channel 4, former BBC Director General Greg Dyke and ex-GCAP Chairman and ITV Chief Exec Richard Eyre have emerged as the frontrunners to replace Luke Johnson as Chairman at the broadcaster. Now, it's possibly fair to say that both of these gentlemen are big cheeses, but I think it's only Greg Dyke who's the big beast. Janine, let's start with you. What do you think a Channel 4 under Greg Dyke would look like?
Do you know, the whole, I can't even bear to engage with the possibility. And this is just as well, I was all nice about radio then, because really, you're about to get it both barrels.
Okay, come on.
This is an absolute disgrace. How can a shortlist for the chairman of Channel 4 include Greg Dyke, Richard Eyre, until 5 minutes ago, apparently Peter Bazalgette, who just ruled himself out? Honestly, the lack of imagination, of wit, of just, these are people, actually, what do they have in common, Greg Dyke and Richard Eyre? They're both incredibly competent people who were the last people we can think of to competently run a terrestrial broadcaster. And that, that's no mean feat. Quite a lot of people have very incompetently run terrestrial broadcasts over the last few years. So they stand out for that alone. I mean, God knows, props to them. But to say that this is the future of Channel 4 fills me with despair. It is like an absolute hands-up admission that we haven't got a clue.
On the blog.
Everything that has got us into this place where we don't know what to do, we don't know who we are, we don't know how to define what we should be, we haven't any sense of purpose. Oh, God, let's reach back 20. That shortlist would have applied not only to the last five go-rounds at ITV, but the Director General of the BBC at the time when Greg got it, to every other possible appointment. And in fact, probably when Luke Johnson got the job, these people were all being mentioned. It is so utterly depressing. Never mind the fact that it's, middle white male. And
yes, well, I haven't got onto that yet.
No, it feels to me a bit like, they're playing a game of TV executive top trumps. He's got everything. He's now getting the last one in the set, which is Channel 4.
I swear to God, the three of us could do better than that. Who are the headhunters?
Right.
And how dare Ofcom, in all honesty, how dare Ofcom sit there and go, we should make this appointment? If they can't give a better brief than that, it's shocking.
On the blog, I'm glad you're
a bit upset, obviously.
Glad we're clear about that.
But Tim Davies doing quite a good job.
Yeah. Industry Cynic on the blog said, what a tiresome shortlist of yesterday's men chosen by Ofcom. Don't they ever get anybody from outside the incestuous little establishment club in inward-looking UK media land? Fortunately, this will be the last chairman before Ofcom is emasculated by the Tories and Channel 4 is ready for privatisation. Bring it on.
I couldn't agree with Industry Cynic more.
I agree too, but I would say it does depend on who the CEO is. I mean, they've got to appoint the chief executive. If they choose someone funky, imaginative, who's
fluffy old Peter Fincham, isn't it? That's partly my problem, Paul, because do you know what? I mean, Greg, we all know, told Luke Johnson to appoint Andy Duncan.
Yeah, it's outrageous. So if not them, then who?
Well, funny you should ask.
Alan Rushbury.
No, I wrote a piece about this actually for Televisual, very good leading monthly magazine for independent producers out now, just yesterday. And as I was writing it, I was thinking, all right, if not them, then who? Who would you suggest? And I thought, Tessa Ross came in here 5 minutes ago. She won't thank me for this. She came in here to conference a couple of weeks ago, to Guardian conference. Certainly not to pitch for consideration at Channel 4. She was talking about the future of the film industry, the future of funding,
yeah,
the
she's
future
the former,
of the creative
former head
industry.
Of drama. At Channel 4 and
she's
format,
still the head of drama and film at Channel 4, and she was talking about how in order to maintain something very important about diversity of creativity in this industry, which says something about our national identity, our creativity, and adding something to the national debate, we basically have to put aside old partialities. And I'm paraphrasing her. She probably wasn't this direct, and I certainly don't want to get her in trouble. But she was talking about working with the BBC on projects. She was talking about lobbying for funding and tax breaks and so on. And basically, in an incredibly sort of collaborative, eloquent, passionate way, talking about the future of the creative industries and talking about the threats of digital and how these need to be combated and so on, in order to get stuff done, not for anybody's aggrandizement, not for anybody's greater power or market share or whatever, just to get stuff done and get it made. And I was listening to her thinking, God, I haven't heard anybody in television or talk like this for a very long time. And I'm absolutely certain she wouldn't be considered for one second for any of these jobs, and I'm sure she wouldn't want to be. And she seems to be extremely good and happy doing what she's doing and incredibly successful at it. She's won Oscars. But why not?
Yeah.
Why aren't people talking to people like her and saying, actually, what would you do? Where are we going wrong?
Because
Channel 4 and BBC have an enormous amount in common, and those negotiations over the last few years have been characterised by defensiveness, power, empire building. No, we don't want to share with you. Off you go.
Do you get the sense, Paul, that actually the British media industry is getting more inward-looking and more incestuous? It certainly seems to me that the pool of talent seems to be getting smaller, not bigger.
Absolutely. I think it's always been inward-looking, but it's now got to an extraordinary, ridiculous length. I do agree with Janine. I think it's absolutely essential that for Channel 4, which is a public service broadcast with a very special remit, you know, Channel 4 needs to do something in the market which is clearly very different to the commercial broadcasts, but also different to the BBC. Otherwise, it has no purpose. You've got to go outside broadcasting. They should be finding someone from another industry who's got flair, imagination, you know, as Janine was saying, and then appoint someone to run it who clearly has got some media experience, because you can't put someone who's got no media experience to run it.
Or even in broadcasting, but outside London.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's extraordinarily lacking any vision and imagination. I'm amazed.
Speaking of executives, what about this news that's come from the BBC this week? They're going to be cutting, apparently, more than 100 senior managers and freezing the pay of its executive board. It still seems that there's that vast number of managers paid an awful lot of money at the BBC.
Well, it's an easy thing to go at every so often in an organisation like that. You probably do have to look at your structures, because they don't half grow. I mean, they every so often, don't they? It seems fairly cyclical to me at my ripe old age. That every so often there's a cull of the corporate centre, or there's a cull of middle management in some bit of the BBC, and that seems inevitable. I would be interested to know how many of those people will be ones that have refused to move to Salford, say, because that's anecdotally, on an individual level, that's all you hear at the moment, is people having conversations about whether they're going to go to Salford. And from what I hear, it's quite easy to get a job at the BBC at the moment if you're prepared to relocate to Manchester.
Yeah, Jaded Hack on the blog says it's fantastic news. Cull some middle-ranking managers next and things will be on the right track. You have to work there to understand just how bloated and opaque the management has become.
Nobody ever made themselves unpopular saying, I'm going to cut out a layer of middle management, did
they?
No,
that's right.
Nobody goes to the streets with the placards going, save our middle management.
Yes, that's true.
Speaking as a middle manager.
Absolutely. There is an issue about executive pay at the BBC, and I'm not sure, Paul, that just freezing it for a year is going to address it. I mean, there are an awful lot of people paid a vast amount of money.
Well, the trouble with freezing is, if what you're saying is, you know, we start from where we are and we're just not going to increase, whereas actually what they should be doing fundamentally is saying, we're a public broadcaster, what do these people do? You know, what is the value? And you shouldn't necessarily look at comparisons, because that's where they get into trouble. They start behaving.
This benchmarking stuff.
They're in the market, and they shouldn't be in the market. You know, if you go to the BBC, you should be paid fairly, but paid knowing you're going into almost like a vocation. So I think this benchmarking is absolutely wrong. Freezing is wrong. Go back and fundamentally look at what you should be doing in terms of pay and restructure.
I'd be happy to go into a vocation if it meant some of those salaries.
Absolutely.
Now, listen, we'll be coming back to the executive tinkering at the BBC.
I don't think envy is a helpful starting point for analysis, frankly.
I know, it's not. You're quite right. I'm really
not very objective, mate.
No, we don't.
We understand it, though.
We do have to be. we do have to be objective on the internet. We'll be coming back, no doubt, to the executive tinkering at the BBC, Channel 4, and God help us, ITV, over the coming weeks.
Oh, what is going on there?
Just don't go there.
They're running quite well without anybody, aren't they?
It's true.
They're doing rather well. I mean, look at their numbers. Simon Cowell's running it, really.
Just put Simon Cowell in charge.
Exactly.
Yes. Keep up to date, of course, on mediaguardian.co.uk. This is Media Talk. I'm Matt Wells. Let's take a quick look at some of the other news stories in the media headlines. Last week, it was Jan Moir who suffered what she claimed was an orchestrated online assault against her column in the Mail. This week, admittedly to a far lesser extent, it was the Sunday Times restaurant critic A.A. Gill who found himself on the wrong end of the Twitterati. He wrote at the weekend about how he'd shot and killed a baboon in Tanzania. As somebody who's been to Malaysia amongst the orangutans, you sound like a ripe candidate for offence.
Well, I am offended, and I was shocked when I heard that the Malaysians are eating orangutans. I mean, it's like eating your brother, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, clearly these animals are very close. Look, it sounds a very cheap comment, and therefore I think it was completely out of place.
It's what Gillen is like are meant to do, aren't they? Provoke a response. I mean, Jan Moir too, really. I mean, that's what, you know, you might not agree with what they say, but that's what they're paid to do, is to provoke a response.
I wasn't entirely sure that he had shot a baboon, because I wouldn't put it past him to have just written it to annoy people at The Guardian, or indeed on Twitter.
Which is not so bad in that case.
In which case, you know, well, fine, we all rose to that. Do you know, I was sort of quite moved when there was the Jan Moir thing. I slightly thought a lot of people, it expressed and synthesised something they'd felt for a very long time about the Sun, about the Mail. It felt for a moment, I think, to that bunch of people anyway, like the mask had slipped and they had inadvertently actually tipped their hand too far, and that was why there was such a furore. And I thought that was quite impressive and sort of brilliant. And then, so however many days later, when A.A. Gill writes some stupid, as you say, Clarkson-esque joke, or indeed confession, who knows, about shooting a baboon on safari, I just thought, well, yes, but I don't know what that teaches us. I mean, yeah, of course, that's a bad thing to make a gag about at the beginning of a restaurant review. On the other hand, I don't feel it's revealed anything to me about the inner workings of, you know, the media.
All right, onto the internet. Peter Mandelson's getting tough with internet piracy. Do you think it's possible to stem the tide in the way that he wants to, Janine?
I think it's an interim measure. I think it's completely unenforceable, really. I was at a fringe meeting at one of the party conferences where they basically admitted as much, the people that were speaking. I think it's a sop to record companies and the like, Universal, the big lobbyists, to say, yes, we're on this, we're doing something about it. And I think it's somewhere between charging people for consumption, which is something the market will inevitably come up with at some point.
Well, as you mentioned charging, at that same conference that Peter Mandelson was speaking at, Ashley Highfield, now of Microsoft, formerly of the BBC iPlayer parish, says that the BBC should charge for stuff on the iPlayer after a certain period. Do you, Paul, do you think that the BBC has sort of skewed the market in a way by not? Because they could have done that to start with.
There's no doubt the BBC has skewed the market. I mean, the argument has to go, I guess, public money invested in content, therefore BBC has a duty to get additional revenue back from that by making it available in other ways. What they should not do is distort the market by offering it for free. So I think offering it on a paid-for basis is the right way to go. It's like buying a video cassette, isn't it?
Exactly.
DVD.
DVD.
Video cassette. DVD.
How long ago was that?
Oh, last week.
But I suppose that they had to go free because it was the first entry to the market.
No, not really. They didn't need to. No, they wanted to build up their business quickly, and that's why they went there, and they wanted to grab market share ahead of competitors. They were actually distorting the market by so doing. It was the wrong thing to do, I think, for a public service broadcaster.
Oh, I couldn't disagree more. Hooray!
Right. Come on, let's have it.
We've got to nail this lie that the BBC is distorting the market. We've just got to nail it, because it comes out of fear from big mainstream media companies who are looking at their revenues from where they've always got them and going, where's that gone? And then, oh, we'll blame them. We'll blame the BBC. It's just not the case. If the BBC's market distortion was so very, very serious that they made it impossible for anybody to make money around them, then Sky would not exist. Sky would simply not exist. If Sky hadn't come in and aggressively bought up sports rights, but then produced considerably better sports coverage than that which had gone before, they would not have a business. And if the BBC was producing all of the great programmes in the world, if there was no room for anybody else to produce a great programme, well, then, you know, ITV wouldn't exist. And you know what? We wouldn't all be watching X Factor on Saturday night. What? The BBC does not have the sole supply on distributing video to the nation.
No, but it does have resources, which, by the way, are public resources, and it does use those in such a way that it does cause market distortion. Sky point is actually bogus, because the fact we've got Sky and the BBC and we've got, God bless it, ITV, actually makes for richness in this country, because you've got three big pots of money. It's why more is spent on TV per capita in the UK than any other market in the world apart from the US, because we've got Sky, the BBC, and we've got advertising. So it's a good thing.
No, and here's another thing, because I agree with you, though it's excellent we have all these rich players all innovating. However, if they didn't have the BBC sitting there churning out stuff for free, they wouldn't have to be better in order to charge either for eyeballs or for advertising. And that's what makes us world leaders, is because actually we are forced to compete with this great big market intervention.
I agree with you about the BBC. Absolutely, the BBC needs to be strong, well funded to enable that to happen, but at the margins, it does distort the market.
I'm Matt Wells, in case you've forgotten. I've just been out to get a cup of tea and to come back in.
If anyone's a disagreement.
Finally, producer Ben, cue the drum roll. Yes, Barbara Windsor is leaving Albert Square. Is this the end for EastEnders?
Well, I was quite surprised, particularly when I heard that she wasn't retiring, but was actually going to go and do other media. But particularly when she said, I'm leaving to spend time with the old man, more time with the old man. The old man is actually 36 years younger than her. So he's 36 and she's 72. Now, if you and I had a partner 36 years younger, we'd be accused of child molestation.
Absolutely. If I ever had a partner who was 36 younger, he wouldn't be born yet.
Exactly.
Good Lord.
How old do you think you are exactly?
36. Actually, I might be 37.
I think you're 37.
I can't remember. Anyway, there we are. Has anybody seen this E20 web spin-off thing?
No.
Well, we'll talk about that with somebody else who has. For some other time. For links to all these stories, head to mediaguardian.co.uk. Now, BSkyB has become embroiled in a battle with Ofcom this week. It's all because the media regulator is considering whether to force the satellite broadcaster to offer premium sport and movie channels to rivals like Virgin Media and BT at cheaper wholesale prices. The bigger picture, of course, is Ofcom's typically never-ending review of the UK pay TV market. Paul, there's been a lot of opposition to Ofcom's plans, well, particularly mostly from Sky and the sports bodies, who say that this would devalue the exclusivity of the deals they have in place with Sky. It's all about sport, this, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Virgin Media and BT have got together, and I mean, in a way, it's an old story. I mean, 10 years ago, Telewest and NTL were saying the same thing, that Sky was wholesaling its movie and sports channels at too high a price and they couldn't take them and make any money on them. So, not new in that sense. The real issue, though, as you say, is sport, because Sky actually does a very good job. With its football particularly, it obviously supports the sport industry because it pays heavily for those rights. You know, there is no doubt that if BSkyB was forced to sell those channels more cheaply, that would actually undermine the amount paid in rights for rugby, for Premier League football, and other sports. So, quite rightly, the governing bodies of the sports organisation said this is actually bad news. The trouble is, there's this sort of view sometimes, you know, a bit like when they were suggesting that the Premier League rights should be cut into different packages, that, you know, competition is good. Well, you know, what happened to Satanta? It didn't actually work. No. The reality is that Sky does a very good job, and that actually benefits sport, and we have to try and think about what's important here.
Now, Virgin posted results this week with smaller losses than expected. You can see from what they're trying to do from their point of view, they can sort out these wholesale prices, maybe finally finally, Virgin can be a viable long-term business.
Yeah, and Virgin have actually really improved over the last 12 months. I mean, their VOD service now is absolutely excellent, but they've still got this issue with these key channels. And, you know, the thing is, sport is still a big driver. Movies, not so much, because now we've all got DVDs. But, you know, sport is still a big driver, and Premier League is the case. You know, I mean, wherever you go in the world, actually, even in Malaysia in the jungle, they're all watching English Premier League.
Well, what about this? The crown jewels argument has come around again this week, and the BBC has been saying that it's going to be sharing the 2013 Ashes with Sky Sports, and then we had, of course, the England Ukraine match on the internet. You feel that the sort of tectonic plates of sports rights are shifting, aren't they?
Yeah, and Sky have to try and close the door on this. You know, if they lose the sport, it will have a big impact on their business. I mean, they're still growing, you know, growing very well, but they've got to do everything they can to protect their sport, and they will.
Janine, anything to say?
I think Paul said it all.
He said
absolutely
it all.
Brilliantly.
So lovely.
I agree entirely with Paul.
Excellent.
And I agree. It was a very good evaluation of what I said.
Great. Listen, we've linked to the original story on this on our blog, where you can find a fine deconstruction of the Sky business model by Media Guardian's harshest critic, Fazer, and why he thinks Sky is closer to the abyss than ever before. Finally, this week before we go, does anyone have anything that they'd like to share with the rest of the class? Janine, what have you learnt this week?
I learnt via Twitter. It's just about a week ago still. Do you remember the dim and distant days when we were all excited about the BNP appearing on Question Time?
Yes, it's in the recesses of my middle memory.
So one of the side things that I learnt that day when they were emptying all the studios out due to the BBC being suddenly closed was that not only do ITV shoot practically all of their shows in the BBC studios.
Yes.
But when I observed this via the mediums of the Twitters, the BBC shoots some of its shows at the ITV studios. I think An Audience with Jonathan Ross is done from the London studios, I'm told. But
and,
also Channel 4.
Yes, no, Have I Got News for You is done from the London studios. Jonathan Ross is done at the BBC. And then Paul O'Grady is done at the BBC.
O'Grady's done at the BBC. And Channel 4 shoots all its shows at the BBC as well.
But what is all this merry-go-round? Why don't they all just stick to their own studios?
And
exactly.
I asked this question, and a BBC producer who I will not name said producer choice.
Yes, there we are. Paul Robinson, what fact can you share with us this week?
I have to go back to my orangutans, and when I was in the jungle, one thing that did happen was I had my script and I'm standing there, you know, merrily sort of trying to direct the talent, and of course the orangutan grabs the script, goes and chews it up, and so the rest is all ad lib. We did very well after that.
Great stuff. Thank you very much. My thanks to the panel, Paul Robinson and Janine Gibson. Media Talk is produced by Ben Green. I'm Matt Wells. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook and all the usual places. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.